Hello there, this is VK3OTN, the official station of the Radio Amateurs Alzheimer's Club of Australia, with this month's news and information bulletin for July 2022 for members and friends of the club. I am Andrew, a VK3 Charlie Alpha Hotel. Details of times and frequencies of when to hear these broadcasts are available at the club's website, www.raotc.org.au. These news broadcasts are available for download for up to 6 months, just in case you miss the original broadcast or want to listen to it again from the club's website. That website once again is www.raotc.org.au. Club News. The Alzheimer's News Journal is available on disc. Here is your opportunity to have a copy of each issue of OTN Journal ever published. All issues of OTN Journal, from the first one published in March 1985, right through to the current issue, are now available as individual PDF files on a DVD data disc. Also included on the data DVD is a comprehensive index in PDF format and a README explanatory file. These OTN on disk data DVDs are available only to RAOTC members for $25 each, which includes pack and postage. If you haven't already got one, why not give yourself a treat? Details on how to order and how to pay are available on the RAOTC website, www.raotc.org.au. New members. Today I am pleased to welcome the following new members to RAOTC: Bill Sawyers, Alpha Juliet 8 Bravo from Ohio in the United States, has become new RAOTC full member number 1836. Tom George, a Victor Kilo 3 a Delta Mike Kilo, became new RAOTC full member number 1837 on the 24th of June 2022. Silent Keys. It is with deep regret we record the passing of the following members: Brian Scott, Victor Kilo 5, November Oscar Sierra, RAOTC member number 1202, became a silent key on Saturday the 14th of May 2022. Aged 92. Peter Zarek, Victor Kilo 6, Alpha Papa Zulu, RAOTC member number 1715, became a silent key on Friday the 3rd of June 2022. We have recently been advised that Len Eaton, Victor Kilo 4, Foxtrot India Alpha Alpha, RAOTC member number 1606, became a silent key on Saturday the 6th of November 2021. Let us pause a moment in honour of our departed colleagues. Membership renewals. A general reminder from our membership secretary, Bill, VK3BR, to those members who have not yet renewed their RAOTC club membership, that annual membership renewals fall due on the 30th of April each year. If your RAOTC membership expired this year, please renew for a further period. Details on how to pay monies to the RAOTC are detailed on the website at www.raotc.org.au. If you have any queries about your membership renewal, please contact Membership Secretary Bill of VK3BR on 0416 177 027 or by email to raotc@raotc.org.au. Once again, that telephone number is 0416 177 027. And that's about all the club news we have for you this month. We have three articles this month. Contributors this month are Clive, VK6CSW, who will tell us a little about QRP in 1922. This is followed by our OTN editor, Bill, VK3BR, who discusses some further thoughts on an article in the March 2012 edition of OTN entitled Before Radar. Both Clive and Bill's articles were first broadcast in June and July 2012. Finally, this month celebrates a very special birthday, 90 years of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Now, it's over to you, Clive.
QRP in 1922. An item from the Sydney Morning Herald, dated the 14th of September, 1922, entitled Wireless Amateur's Achievement. Mr. Charles McClurkin, the well-known wireless amateur of Strathfield, New South Wales, has established an interesting record in low-power transmission by sending telegraphy and speech from his station at Strathfield to Melbourne and Mungindi, using a power of only 3.2 watts. Mr. McClurkin repeated this performance both by day and by night. Some idea of the significance of Mr. McClurkin's achievement may be gauged when it is stated that the power utilized to light the average tail lamp of a motor car is about 9 watts. Mr. McClurkin has, therefore, transmitted telegraphy and speech to Melbourne and up to the Queensland border with just a little more than one-third of this power. The latest wireless information to hand from overseas refers to tests made in England and states that the record there in July last, that is July 1921, was speech 84 miles and telegraphy 200 miles with a 28-watt input. Some little time ago, Mr. McClurkin succeeded in communicating with the steamer Montoro, which was then north of Darwin, and a distance of more than 2,000 miles from Sydney, using only 9 watts of power. Arrangements were made with Mr. R. A. Hull of Melbourne, Mr. H. A. Warden of Mungindi, and Mr. L. V. S. Todd of Tamworth, New South Wales, to listen in on Friday last at 7:30 p.m., and also on Sunday last at noon. Mr. McClurkin transmitted speech and music commencing on full power of 8.5 watts and later changing to 6 watts and finally to 3.2 watts. On Sunday, transmission was made with 8.7, 6.2 and 3.8 watts. A secret code letter was used to indicate change of power. All the receiving stations reported all the code letters each day, and Mr. Warden and Mr. Todd clearly heard the speech and music on the lowest power. And there the item ends. Many listeners, of course, will recognize the names of Charles McClurkin and R. A. Hull, but some may not, so perhaps a quick comment is in order. Charles McClurkin, born in 1889, was issued with experimental license number 10, callsign XDM, in 1910, and in 1921 was issued with the very first radio license for broadcast station 2CM, broadcasting from Sydney's Wentworth Hotel, which was then owned by his family. He was also a well-known Sydney amateur who, as president of the Wireless Institute of Australia, New South Wales Division, made contact with a British amateur, Mr. Simmons, of Gerrard's Cross in Buckinghamshire, on November 25, 1924, and a day later made the first two-way trans-Pacific amateur contact, speaking to a Mr. Williams in Pomona, California, for about 10 minutes on 78 meters. A year later, in June 1925, in one evening alone, he made contact with six countries, Sweden, England, Brazil, France, Italy, and America. Ross A. Hull was born in Melbourne in 1902 and is best known to amateurs for his pioneering work in the field of development of the VHF and UHF spectrum, but he was also a highly skilled model engineer, a pioneer of radio control model aircraft, and for some years the technical editor of QST magazine in America. At the age of 20, he became the first Australian to hear signals from American amateurs. Tragically, he died in 1938 at the age of 36, accidentally electrocuting himself while experimenting with amateur television. Each year, we hold the Ross Hull Memorial Contest on VHF and UHF to remember his immense contribution to our hobby.
You're listening to VK3OTN, the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia.
Before radar, following on to the interesting 1933 Listener In reprint published in the March 2012 issue of OTN magazine, which generated quite a bit of interest amongst RAOTC members, here is a brief summary of some further research I carried out on the subject of sound location. Prior to the development of radar, sound or acoustic location was originally used for ship detection in fog conditions. It was also the only technology available for detecting aircraft at a distance, and was used from mid-World War I to the early years of World War II for the passive detection of aircraft by picking up the noise of the engines. The first practical means of detecting airplanes at a distance at night was by listening to the noise of their engines with the aid of horns. The instruments usually consisted of large horns connected to the operator's ears using tubing, much like a very large stethoscope. The size of the horns served to gather in more of the sound, and thus increased the range of detection. The spacing of the horns aided the operator's binaural sense in determining the plane's direction. However, as World War II neared, radar began to become a credible alternative to the sound location of aircraft, although the British sound location stations were left in operation as a backup to radar. Interestingly, as Germany's war machine was speedily rebuilt in the late 1930s, German radar research was far behind developments in Great Britain. The Germans used sound locators extensively during the early years of World War II to help aim searchlights at night flying bombers. Sound ranging for artillery spotting had a secure place during World War II. Aircraft sound location proved less useful. During the Battle of Britain, sound location was used as a backup for radar in locating inbound aircraft. But because aircraft in World War II were much faster than in World War I, aircraft sound location gave only a few minutes of warning. Needless to say, this made it a much less attractive approach than radar. After World War II, sound location played no further role in anti-aircraft operations. But because the cost of the associated sensors and electronics continued to fall, the use of sound location technology became more accessible for other uses, such as locating artillery and locating wildlife, etc. I understand that, in at least some of the large cities in the US, sound ranging is still being used to determine the location of gunfire. Also, it seems that acoustic detectors are still being used today to pick up the sounds of players and coaches on the field during televised sporting events, where the use of conventional microphones would be too intrusive. They're also used as novelty items or whisper dishes in science museums to allow patrons to whisper across long distances. Incidentally, Britain never publicly admitted it was using radar until well into World War II. Instead, publicity was given to acoustic location. It has been suggested that the Germans remained wary of the possibility of acoustic location, and that is why the engines of their heavy bombers were run unsynchronized instead of synchronized, as was the usual practice, in the hope that this would make detection more difficult. It seems that the first Japanese air raids on the American-held island of Corregidor in late December of 1941 were detected by acoustic locators. I also understand that, as late as 1943, the American media were presenting sound locators as being current equipment for locating aeroplanes at night. This was another piece of misinformation, as radar sets were already in widespread use at that time. Before the advent of the aeroplane, acoustic location was applied to determining the presence and position of ships in fog, However, this changed during World War I when the Germans attempted to break British morale by launching a series of airship raids on Great Britain. By 1917, it was apparent that the airship raids had failed because they were too vulnerable to anti-aircraft fire and British fighter aircraft aided by searchlights. Following the failure of airships, the next German attempt to break British morale was to use heavy bombers. These could carry 300 kilograms of bombs. However, attacks using these aircraft in daylight failed due to British fighter defence. The Germans then started attacking at night, but the British had formed a ring barrier of anti-aircraft guns with accompanying searchlights about 25 miles from London, located to split up the attackers and make them more vulnerable to fighter aircraft. The German bomber raids were tracked by sound locators, and the anti-aircraft guns, searchlights and fighter aircraft were alerted. Apparently, the sound locators were very effective for identification of some of the German bombers, but not for others. As in World War I, searchlights form part of a system of nighttime aircraft detection in World War II. Once a locator locked on to an aerial target, both searchlights and guns were trained on the target, so the target could be nearly simultaneously illuminated and then destroyed. Locators were first based on sound and heat detection, and ultimately radar became the preferred method of target acquisitions. Units were generally separate, but advances in radar technology late in the war saw the integration of radar into both searchlight and anti-aircraft gun designs. Anti-aircraft artillery accuracy was a problem, both from tactical and economic points of view. In 1940, in England, for example, it took an average of 20,000 rounds of ammunition to down a single enemy aircraft. The demand for more accurate methods of engaging, tracking, and destroying aircraft, especially at night, was driven by the need to destroy more targets without expending excessive amounts of ammunition. Over the years, some weird and wonderful acoustic sound locators were designed and built. The most impressive looking were probably the Japanese Tuba sound locator, and the most remarkable looking piece of equipment was possibly the French acoustic locator based on a hexagonal layout. Each of the four assemblies carried 36 smaller hexagonally shaped horns. This layout was presumably used to increase the directional gain of the equipment, but because the detector was so large and out in the open, the style was abandoned after being repeatedly bombed by the enemy. The most effective sound locator was probably the German RRH. This detector was used mainly in anti-aircraft searchlight batteries for the detection of British night bomber formations. The RRH could detect targets at a distance of 12 kilometres, and, depending upon weather conditions and operator skill, it could help detect the size of the aircraft formation. It had a directional accuracy of 2 degrees and had a crew of 3 with the dial reader in the middle. The RRH was mainly used in World War II anti-aircraft searchlight batteries for initial aiming of the searchlight at night targets, presumably because it was cheaper and easier to make than a radar set. Later in the war, of course, they were replaced by radar sets. Like the British and French versions, the RRH was also composed of 4 horns, 2 to determine bearing and 2 for elevation. Over the years, the British and Americans used a variety of small acoustic detectors of limited effectiveness. However, the British did build a series of large, stationary, concrete acoustic mirrors, some of which are still standing to this day. Sound mirrors normally work by using movable microphones to find the angle that maximizes the amplitude of sound received, which is also the bearing angles of the target. 2 sound mirrors at different positions will generate 2 different bearings, which allow the use of triangulation to determine a sound source's position, but they are huge and not portable. A typical example is located at Denge, a former Royal Air Force site near Dungeness in Kent, where a set of early experimental acoustic mirrors still remain. There are three acoustic mirrors in the complex, each consisting of a single concrete hemispherical reflector. The 60-meter mirror is a near-vertical curved wall, 60 meters long and 8 meters high. It is one of only two similar acoustic mirrors in the world, the other being in Maghtab, Malta. The 9-meter diameter mirror is a circular dish, similar to a deeply curved satellite dish, supported on concrete buttresses. This mirror still retains the metal microphone pole at its center. The 6-meter diameter mirror is similar to the 9-meter mirror, but with a smaller, shallower dish. The British were well along with large-scale radar installation as the German Blitzkrieg burst across continental Europe. But, taking nothing for granted, the British set up a significant number of concrete sound mirrors facing across the English Channel, and a number of these parabolic shells survive even today.
Thanks, Bill. Our final article this month discusses the 90th anniversary of Australia's public broadcaster, the ABC. You're listening to VK3OTN, the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia. Australia's public broadcaster celebrates 90 years. Launched in 1932, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation has become a much-loved part of Australian society and its cultural fabric. From a single radio service, the ABC has developed into a multi-platform media operation and a public broadcaster of international renown, delivering Australian stories and conversations across the nation and to the region. It effectively replaced the Australian Broadcasting Company, a private company established in 1924 to provide programming for A-class radio stations. The ABC Charter, set down by Parliament, requires the corporation to provide informative, entertaining and educational services that reflect the breadth of our nation. Although the ABC is celebrating 90 years, the forerunners of the ABC are almost 100 years old. Back in the 1920s, governments worldwide were trying to figure out ways to regulate this new medium of wireless. The genie could not be put back into the bottle. There were 12 founding stations that formed the initial ABC network. Call signs were allocated by the Postmaster General, or PMG, at the time, with the first character a number representing the military district in which the station was located, similar to the way that amateur call signs were allocated up until recently. Here are those 12 founding stations listed in call sign order. TVL Sydney. Its first call sign was 2SB. The SB stood for Sydney Broadcasters Limited. However, the call sign soon became 2BL for Sydney Broadcasters Limited. 2CO, Corowa, which serves the Albury and Riverina region. 2FC, Sydney. 2FC stood for Farmering Company, the original owner of the station before the ABC bought the station in 1932. 2NC, Newcastle. 3AR, Melbourne, Associated Radio Company of Australia. 3LO, Melbourne. 3LO originally operated on long wave using 174 kHz, that is 720 metres. The frequency was subsequently changed to 810 kHz medium wave in 1925. 4QG Brisbane, Queensland Government. 4RK Rockhampton. 5CK Crystal Brook, which is Port Pirie. 5CL Adelaide, Central Broadcasters Limited. 6WF Perth. It was the last Australian station to commence under the sealed set scheme. It was originally owned by Australian Farmers Cooperative and operated from a studio in the Australian Farmers Building in Perth. The final station was 7ZL in Hobart. Over the years, the stations have occupied several different frequencies. The ABC rolled out a national network across the country somewhat similar in nature to the BBC national program. The ABC has never really stopped to evolve and reinvent itself. Later, along came some more stations. TCY, Canberra, in 1938. 2NA, Newcastle, in 1943. 4QR, Brisbane, 1938. And 6WN in Perth, in 1938. The first transmitters for 2FC, 5CL and 4QG were made by AWA with a power of 5,000 watts or 5 kilowatts, defined in terms of DC input to the final amplifier, which typically was about 3 times that of the power into the antenna. Thus today, the power would be stated as about 1.7 kilowatts. Class C was not in common use or particularly well understood in those days. They used an MT7A valve for the final high power RF stage and an MT7B for the modulator. The power supply was 12,000 volts from a three phase power source rectified by MR7 valves. 4QG commenced with a 500 watt transmitter, which continued for about 6 months until the 5 kilowatt unit was commissioned. The radio transmitters for 3AR and 2FC were upgraded to 10 kilowatts in a contract let in 1938 to STC, Standard Telephones and Cables. The transmitters were designed by Charles Strong in London and were notable for using negative feedback to ensure a high quality, flat frequency response. From 1947 until the mid-1980s, Radio 2, as it came to be known, was broadcast to the major metropolitan centres with a large broadcast footprint in adjacent areas due to the powerful AM transmitters in use. It contained most of the ABC's national programming. Many of the frequency allocations on the lower end of the AM broadcast band are allocated to the ABC. Lower frequencies travel further via ground wave for a given power, provided an efficient antenna is used. It is no accident that most of the allocations on the lower end of the AM broadcast band are used by the ABC. A 5/8 wave length antenna mast provides the best angle of radiation for optimising ground wave propagation. Height is always might, however, height costs money. This was discovered 99 years ago by Charles Ballantyne, and he first published a paper in 1924. The use of a capacity hat to artificially increase the electrical height of an antenna achieves the same result at a far lower cost. Clive, VK6CSW, wrote a very interesting article covering this topic, which is published in the September 2015 edition of OTN. Back issues of OTN, in fact all back issues, are available on a single disc only to RAOTC members at a very low cost. The power level of 2FC and 3AR was upgraded to 50 kilowatts in the early 1950s. The transmitters for these stations were housed in the same building as the Radio 1 network, 2BL and 3LO. They were manufactured by STC. The final stage amplifier contained three parallel 3J/261E air-cooled triodes running in Class C at 90% efficiency. These were driven by a Class B push-pull modulator with the same type of valves. 5CL had to wait until late 1961 when a new joint facility with 5AN was opened in Pimpala, a suburb of Adelaide. The ABC officially commenced on the 1st of July 1932, 90 years ago. Happy birthday to the ABC. I hope you've enjoyed this short article on your ABC, and a more detailed article is published in an upcoming edition of OTN, which is mailed out twice a year in March and September to members of the club. If you're not a member, then why not consider joining? Details on how to join the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club is contained on our web page, www.raotc.org.au.
Hello everyone, this is Clive, VK6 Charlie Sierra Whiskey, reminding you that the next lunchtime meeting for members and friends of the RAOTC is at the Bayswater Hotel, Bayswater, starting at around midday, and that the buffet is back on the menu once again. Everyone's welcome to join in and have an eyeball QSO, but do remember that WA public health rules apply in all restaurants.
In keeping with tradition, we conclude this broadcast with a short story. Smartest answer of the year. A teacher at West Australian High School reminded her pupils of tomorrow's final exam. "Now listen to me. I won't tolerate any excuses for you not being here tomorrow. I might consider a nuclear attack, a serious personal injury, illness, or a death in your immediate family, but that's it. No other excuses whatsoever." A smart aleck teenager at the back of the room raised his hand and asked, "What would happen if I came in tomorrow suffering from complete and utter sexual exhaustion?" The entire class was reduced to laughter and sniggering. When silence was restored, the teacher smiled at the student, shook her head, and sweetly said, "Well, I would expect you to write the exam with your other hand." And that humorous story was supplied by Clive, VK6CSW.
That's about all we have for you this month, and we hope you found something of interest. Thanks for being with us, and we hope you will join in the callbacks, where callbacks are taken. We look forward to being with you on the first Monday of next month, except January. 73 from VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia.